Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast with me, Craig Barton. A show where I interview people who interest and inspire me from the wonderful world of education. This particular episode is from Season 3 of my Research in Action mini-series, where I interview researchers from Loughborough University's Centre for Mathematical Cognition about their chosen areas of interest and, crucially, the implications for teachers in the classroom. And I try and fail not to come across completely out of my depth. For this particular season, we have 6 episodes, and this is in fact the final, the season finale, and it's a good one, because this week we have Vic Sims. Vic is a professor of developmental psychology at Ulster University. Her recent research interests have been in understanding the influence of the home environment on early mathematics development, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Vic's also interested in understanding influences on development from cross-country perspectives and developmental differences for those children born, for example, preterm or with genetic conditions. It's an absolutely fascinating conversation, this. Now, if you've been listening to all episodes in this series, you know that when I recorded them, I'd lost my voice. So apologies in advance for the croakiness, coughs, and squeakiness. Enjoy. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Vic Sims to the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast. Hey, Vic, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no, my pleasure, my pleasure. Can you tell listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yep, so my name is Victoria Sims. I'm a professor of developmental psychology at Ulster University in Northern Ireland. Our university has 3 campuses throughout Northern Ireland, and I'm the lucky one to be located right on the north coast of Northern Ireland near the sea, which is fabulous. And I've been doing research for probably the past 15 years in child development. And obviously I'm here to talk about mathematics, but I also do a lot of work on developmental outcomes of kids born at risk. So for example, we follow up kids who are born with congenital heart disease, kids who are born very preterm. But most of my work focuses on children and their development of mathematical thinking.
Wow, amazing. That's absolutely fantastic. We start, as we always do, with the math speed dating questions. So question number one, what is your favourite number and why?
So I actually don't have a favourite number, but I have a most hated number. And that is and that's the number 7. And I'm pretty convinced that when I was in primary school, I had a pretty severe bout of chicken pox. And during the time when I had chicken pox, we learned our 7 times tables. And I am convinced that I still have some issues with the 7 times tables because I missed that those few weeks of time when we were learning the 7 times tables. So I don't like the number 7.
Wow, that's a first. I've done, 200 episodes of this, something like that. Never had a least favourite number. That's good. And my little boy, Isaac, he always asks me what my least favourite number is, and I never have an answer. So I'm gonna share that one with him. That's very, very good. That's good. Question number 2, what was your favourite topic in maths as a student?
Oh, so I had a really interesting experience with maths as a student because I did mathematics A-level and I did enjoy it greatly, but I absolutely loved mechanics. I just really loved the idea of it being something real and tangible and earthly. I wasn't so good with the pure mathematics at all, but the mechanics for me was brilliant. My husband at the time, he wasn't my husband at the time, I wasn't married when I was at school, but he was just going to study engineering. And I remember us having these chats around the kind of physics and mechanics and thinking, oh, I really love this subject so much. So it was kind of like our early relationship was forged over the love of mechanics, which sounds quite sad, but anyhow.
Wow, romantic. We'll go romantic. That's lovely. That's brilliant. Love it. And question number 3, what job would you like to do if you weren't involved in education research?
I think I would probably really like to think about stepping into the charitable sector. And that probably would still involve a tiny bit of research in terms of efficacy of interventions. But, you know, a lot of our work can sometimes feel quite theoretical, abstract, removed from the real world. And, you know, I would really like to work in early intervention, for example. I think that would be brilliant.
Nice. Fantastic stuff. Right. Now, before we dive into the main topic of today, I always like to ask guests about a favorite failure. So something that didn't go according to plan in your career, but you learned something valuable from the experience.
I think my favorite failure is probably a succession of failures at job interviews. I am a very enthusiastic person and I find it quite difficult sometimes to hold back my passion. And I have a very clear memory of my first two interviews for lectureships. And the very first one was in a university that shall not be named, I knew some people there. And I think instantly when I walked into the interview panel, that kind of professionalism that we try and put on at interview was dropped because I knew they knew me far too well. So the first interview was a disaster. I then went for a subsequent interview where I basically said, when I was asked about the specific topic that the lectureship was in, I said I had no idea about that field at all, and I don't really know how I got shortlisted. So those two interviews were catastrophic. And I think from that, I really learned how to hold my own and hold my somewhat level of professionalism, supposedly, but also how to kind of be able to talk my way out of a big problem. So not admitting that I don't have anything about a subject that I'm trying to get a job in is the first start.
Nice. I like it. Very, very good. Right. Okay. So what are we going to be talking about today, Vic?
Well, I think today we'd really like to chat about some of the work that we've been doing in terms of the home maths environment and how that kind of prepares children for school entry and how that can help or hinder their developmental outcomes in terms of how they learn about very early mathematics skills.
Amazing. Fantastic. Right. Okay. So just set the scene in terms of age group. What are we talking about here for the students, for the children?
Yes. Yeah, so we're really thinking about children who are aged 3 to 5 years old. In terms of the research based on the home mathematics environment, there is some research that looks at children when they're in the primary school age group. And there is actually some more emerging research that also looks at adolescents and the influence of the home environment on their learning, mainly through homework support. But what we were particularly fascinated by and really interested in is trying to understand what happens before school entry. Because I'm sure you're well aware of this. I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of this, that children, when they enter into school, we can nearly describe some of their outcomes as being baked in. So there's really amazing data that's come from this huge longitudinal cohort study in the States that looks at children when they come into school and measures their math skills literally within the first few weeks of being in school. And actually what you see is children who enter school with poor math skills kind of track along the bottom of kids who have entered with higher math skills. So what we really want to understand as researchers looking at this home maths environment is this something that is differentiating children when they enter into school? And is there anything we can do before children enter into school to help support those children's learning and also to be able to make that link between the home and the school environment to try and bolster children's early learning?
Wow. I'll tell you what, Vic, I'm going to apologize in advance. This is going to be like a personal therapy session for me, this, because I've got a 4-year-old, right, Isaac, who's going to school in September. And I reckon I've already messed things up here for him big time. Well, so we might dig into this as we go, because like, obviously I love maths and he's a bit obsessed with maths as well, but a little bit too much. He doesn't really have much other chat at the moment. He's just chatting to people about numbers left, right, and centre. So it'll be interesting just how much damage I've done to him there.
Yeah, and I think this is kind of personal for me too, because actually I wasn't interested in the home math environment at all as a researcher until I had my daughter. And then I suddenly realised this kind of amazing natural exposure to math being all around us kind of really highlighted to me that it was something that I wanted to research. And actually, I have this fundamental moment. It was actually during COVID lockdown, Greg, when she was spontaneously came to me. I have a video recording of this. She came to me with a tea towel. She was about 2.5. And I was folding the washing and she came over and she folded the tea towel in half and then she folded it in half again and kind of put it down. And I thought, oh my goodness, what an amazing mathematical experience. And from that's really ignited my interest in what parents are doing intentionally, but also completely unintentionally to try and support their children's exposure to mathematical concepts and for their mathematical learning.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll let you lead the way initially, then I'll come in with some annoying questions as we go. Do you want to talk me through some of the things that you've kind of studied and found out and how that research has been conducted?
Yeah, so I suppose to start off with, one of the things that really prompted our thinking, actually, all of my work on the home environment, well, a large amount of the work that's been done in the home math environment has been done in collaboration with Abby Gahoon, who's also at Ulster University. And in that work, Abby first came to me because I was really interested in the minutiae of cognition, and she's wanted to do a PhD and thought, let's broaden this out. So being inspired by Farah, my daughter, but also by Abby Gahoon, who was a really good person to kind of question that. Look, it was pretty clear that the literature was very, very inconsistent in terms of these associations between what parents do, generally reporting frequency of activities that they might do at home, and children's mathematical learning. And one of the reasons why we thought that this might be, these inconsistencies might be coming out, is because all of this research is done in lots of different countries, obviously being psychological research, mainly in the US and Europe. But one of the things that was really interesting is our measurement of what the home math environment might be is kind of taken from a few researchers in Canada. And we take these scales of measurement and we have applied them to all of these different countries. So they might not be kind of culturally relevant. So that was the first thing that we wanted to think about. So we've done a really lovely pieces of qualitative interviews with parents just to understand what naturally they engage with their 3 to 5 year olds in terms of the home math environment. And what we find is, unsurprisingly, parents are incredibly sensitive and recognize what things are appropriate for 3 to 5 year olds. And a lot of that is about counting. And really importantly, and especially in your context and with the English curriculum, loads of shape and space, unsurprisingly. And so those types of things came very clearly through our qualitative interviews. And actually, really recently, we've just a paper that's under review at this point in time where we've done similar qualitative interviews with parents in Cuba and in Mexico. And we're finding really interesting cross-country differences in terms of how parents engage with their little children. Interestingly for us, in Mexico, the interactions are a little bit more formal and influenced a little bit more by a closer interaction between parents and the preschool environment, the teachers, that we didn't see necessarily in Northern Ireland. So that was kind of our starting point for really understanding whether there were these kind of cross-country differences and whether these scales that we had that were taken from North America were actually appropriate for our context. And actually, we found there was quite a lot of things that parents do similarly to parents in Canada. But actually, we had to add quite a lot of items to our scale to make it kind of country relevant. And that was really interesting for us. So Abby's PhD mainly was this huge amount of work to develop a measure that parents could complete at home easily to be able to report how frequently they were engaging with certain activities. And then also, how did they give their children support at home? How would they correct an incorrect answer? Were their children interacting with siblings? And a really big thing that we had to add to our survey was around technology use. So around the use of technology. And what we find there actually in the qualitative interviews is that parents, yes, are using technology with their children. They're quite wary of the use of technology with those 3 to 5 year olds, but they're really using it to kind of support them to get over their own anxiety with mathematics, even though what we may think, you know, 3 to 5 year old mathematics, pretty straightforward, not too complex. Many parents are still very worried about getting things wrong, you know, embedding and teaching some information that might not be correct, but using that technology to inspire them to think about different ideas as well. So that was kind of the first bit of research that we did in the home math environment, the qualitative aspect, which I find really interesting as someone who's like been brought up in a discipline that is very cognitive, very quantitative. It was my first kind of exploration into that qualitative work, and that was really, really insightful and led us to develop this scale that is now being used by other researchers and that we've been able to take now and with the new data that we've got from Mexico and Cuba and adapt that scale as well. So it's country specific for us to be able to do that type of work in different countries as well. So it's been really, really fascinating.
Wow. Can we dig into this scale a little bit? Because I'm really interested with this. So what are the kind of things that are on there? What are the kind of things you're asking parents
what they do
at home?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're asking parents to report about the frequency of their activities over a period of a week, for example. And that can be about things that are not stretching. So very simple things, maybe counting the number of ducks that are in the bath, things that are slightly more stretching, like weighing and measuring, comparing size, comparing quantities. Also then engagement with educational materials such as storybooks with counting words within them. Things like watching educational TV programs. Unsurprisingly, in the UK, number blocks comes up all the time. It's very, very popular. And then obviously around educational technology, such as number-based applications, for example, or playing racing games. So you're kind of thinking about first, second, third. So those are the types of things that parents are reporting on within that scale.
And is there any distinction made between kind of the quality of those interactions, if that makes sense? And I'm just thinking, you know, like, it's one thing sticking number blocks on, but it's another thing kind of chatting to your child whilst they're watching it. Same, I guess, with like playing a board game and stuff. Is there any distinction made between the quality of the interactions?
Yeah, so I think this is a real kind of the crux of where we're at the minute in terms of this research on the home mathematics environment. So during COVID, actually, a large group of international researchers got together to develop a position piece on the home math environment. And one of the things that came out from that, I think there's about 25 co-authors on this paper, was this lack of our understanding of the quality of the interaction at home. Obviously, it's quite straightforward. Well, it's difficult to recruit parents, full stop, into studies. but it is quite forward to ask people to complete a questionnaire. But to ask people for access to their home to assess the quality of the interaction is a completely different thing. So a lot of our work has focused on these frequency-based measures, but I find that deeply unsatisfying. What we've seen in terms of the relationship between the frequency of engagement with activities and children's outcomes is actually quite a weak correlation, quite a weak relation between those two things. You know, if you look at an R value, the R value is generally around 0.2. So it's quite a small association. And one of the reasons why we think this might be is because most of us are focusing on frequency-based measures. No one's tapping into the real quality of that interaction. And so we've kind of taken two different approaches to try and start to understand the quality of the interactions itself. So we've got work that we're currently analysing that has looked at, and you may freak out at this as a parent yourself because this is really hard to recruit into, where we've asked families to take this little digital voice recorder into their homes. And it's a really clever piece of technology because it can differentiate between adult voice and child voice due to the pitch. So we can look at turn-taking around different types of mathematical events. And we can then also transcribe all of the interaction to be able to code it for the types of quality of the interaction itself. So we're hoping that these data may be much more insightful in terms of the quality of the interactions. I also have an amazing PhD researcher working with me, Colette Duncan, who's been looking more so at children who may struggle with learning mathematics. And in that study, she's looked at parent-child interactions to be able to code for the quality of the interaction. And that's been through Zoom interactions. So she sent parents out three little games to play with their children, and she's recorded them for 15 minutes. And this sounds really mad, that's only a 15 minute interaction, but actually we're getting unbelievable data out of that in terms of the quality of the interaction. And what's really nice is that one of the games is very shape based. One game is really stretching for preschoolers. It's a shopping game, and you know, we're using 2p coins and 5p coins. That's really complex for 3 and 5 year olds. And then another game is quite straightforward, just like a little number race game. And we're seeing the differences in terms of parents' sensitivity to be able to get their children to focus on the goal of the task, to try and keep children's attention. When things get hard, we lose children's attention. I know you probably really feel that as a parent yourself. And so we're seeing that parents are really adapting their sensitivity and support and their broader cognitive support when the difficulty of the task really ramps up. So these types of things that we're doing are much more able to tap into the quality question. But they're really difficult to get to do because obviously certain types of parents will be more happy to let us into their homes, really, even if it's not physically into their homes. They are opening the door to us, and that is a much more difficult recruitment process in terms of research.
Jeez, flipping out. God, I've absolute bags of questions already on this, Vic. So I'll just fire a few at you. We'll see where we'll see where this goes. The first thing is just to clarify, and this is probably the most obvious thing in the world. I'm guessing, it's probably impossible to answer, right? The ideal combination is the quality and the quantity of these interactions. Mm. But if you had to choose one or the other, is it the kind of, you want some high quality interactions as opposed to just a load of kind of master? What's your instinct there?
Yeah, so I think, to be absolutely honest, I don't really know at this point in time because we don't have the data, the sufficient data on the quality. One, I think that what we're talking about here is there's multiple factors. We obviously, children who are never exposed to anything mathematical at home are going to struggle with learning these new concepts. They're very complex concepts, and they're things that can be really easily incidentally exposed. Children can be incidentally exposed to. But I think what we can see sometimes is actually some really nice work from the States where children who were struggling to learn mathematics, where you see that parents are increasing the frequency of the exposure. So you see this kind of unexpected negative correlation. So you see children who are struggling learners have parents who are really doing lots of high frequency of activities. And the reason why the researchers in America believe that this is the case is because parents are being really sensitive. Mm-hmm. So I do think there is something about the balance of a frequency where we don't want children to feel like this isn't meant to be a beautiful environment where children feel happy and successful. And if we're encouraging parents just to do lots of stuff, and it's not good stuff, then that's going to be a problem. And actually, I have in a lecture slide that I use all the time, this Northern Irish publicity campaign around the home environment that I thought was just an awful publicity campaign that was do more stuff with your kids. Yeah. You're like, wait a second, we need to be able to give advice to parents about what the quality stuff is and then how to balance this out as well, because obviously mathematics is really important. I'm on a maths podcast, I believe this fully, but in the early years it is also about getting the balance of everything else. You know, it's about reading, it's about the arts, it's about creativity, but there is that real opportunity for mathematics to be embedded in all these things anyway. So I think the balance between frequency and quality is very important. And I think some really in this kind of context, maybe less frequency and better quality is probably going to win. But we don't have, I couldn't say this based on empirical literature because that just I don't feel exists yet. One thing that we have got that's just a paper that's just been accepted, which I'm really excited by, is a meta-analysis of home-based interventions. So this is kind of like a wide-sweeping interventions looking at both literacy outcomes and more numeracy outcomes in the early years. What we found, first of all, when we did this big search of the literature was there are tons more literacy interventions than there are maths interventions, not surprising. But really interestingly, the kind of thinking of the mechanisms of change is thinking about these interventions where training parents to have quality interactions, and also some of them were giving them high quality resources to use with their children. And what you see is actually a small impact on literacy outcomes for kids from these, you know, when we collapse everything together, and you see a slightly larger impact on maths outcomes. And so what's really interesting here is that when you compare the interventions that you might do in school in contrast to the interventions that have happened in the home, they actually are showing larger effects. So there's something about the benefit of early intervention, and there's something about the focus on increasing the quality of the interaction and the quality of the resource that seems to be having this impact on mathematics outcomes, or sorry, more numeracy outcomes in the early years.
It's really interesting. It's absolutely fascinating, this. You alluded to this before, Vic, about differences in countries. I wonder if you could just dig into that a little bit more. What are some of the most significant differences about what parents in different countries are doing with their children at this early age that you've picked up on?
So I suppose there's some really interesting things that we've seen from our own research team, and then I am kind of broad reader of literature from everywhere else. what we see in terms of China, for example, parents in China really are very focused on school entry, because you do an assessment at school entry to be able to access certain types of education. Hong Kong as well would have similar structures. So you see there's quite a lot of formalization of the home mathematics environment in China and in Hong Kong. A really close collaborator of mine is based in Chile, in Santiago. And what we see in the Chilean culture is really large amounts of gender disparities in terms of mathematics learning. And fascinatingly, and really unusually for a lot of developmental psychology research, Manet Susburgi has been able to recruit mums and dads into studies, because generally what we see is a lot of research on what mums do at home. So when we're talking about the home maths environment, we're generally talking about mothers' perceptions of the home maths environment. And what she's found is that fathers, Chilean fathers, are the individuals that are stretching their children's mathematics learning, doing a little bit more challenging work with those children. Our own work in Chile, in Cuba and Mexico has been really interesting, because there is this very clear influence, we think, from our qualitative research on kind of traditional aspects of life that kind of feed into learning. So things like the use of song and the use of generating your own resources. So Cuba is a really good example of a country that has high value load on educational outcomes. Education is very respected, but at the same time, really poor access to resources, to toys. So families are really generating their own materials to be able to work with their own children. And that, I think, is why we saw this quite strong influence of the preschool sector on what parents are doing at home, because a lot of these resources are being shared between the preschool and the home itself. So really different kind of cultural approaches, because of the values that we place on education that are different across the globe. So that work has been absolutely fascinating. But I suppose one of the papers that I'm really excited about that's just been published the end of last week, is a paper that we've done in collaboration with some researchers in the States. So Alexa Ellis is based at the University of Alabama. And I'm sure you're aware of the TIMSS study, which is the International Comparison Study of Maths and Sciences. And what we were able to do there was get the data from that survey. So you've got outcomes of children when they're 8 years old, and parents are also reflecting back on what they did with their kids when they were younger. So this is an amazing opportunity. So there's about 250,000 parents and children in this study. And what we've been able to do is look at the relationship between what parents reported reflecting back on what they did with their kids and children's outcomes at age 10. And it's really fascinating, because this is very consistent with a recent meta-analysis that we see this kind of weak relation, 0.2, between what parents reported doing and their children's outcomes. And we can see how the rates of engagement with home-based activities change over countries. So actually, hilariously for me, and this is totally empirical, it is not bias, people in Northern Ireland engage the most frequently with home mathematics activities at home with their children. And that when that came out of the data set, I had to laugh, because I thought that was just so, so funny. And we can see that there is variation across countries in terms of the reporting of what they're doing. The survey data from this from the TIMSS study has not loads of questions about the home mathematics environment, so we have to kind of keep that in mind. But I think it's such an amazing opportunity to be able to look at something that we've been struggling to understand in a kind of the context of the globe, and understanding what the home math environment might mean and might be. So to be able to have a look at that type of data has just been really, really fascinating.
Wow. Okay. I'm absolutely loving this. This next question is probably going to be either a bad question or one you might not be able to answer, but I just wonder, so we will have lots of parents listen to this, this podcast. Do you get a sense that there's almost kind of a hierarchy of things that parents either should or shouldn't do for their environment? And I'll tell you what I'm thinking here. So it seems to me like number one on the list should be not to kind of be slagging off maths left, right, and center and saying, you know, it's terrible, blah, blah, blah. Then number two, it feels to me like it should be to do some kind of, you know, something to do with numbers, whether it's, as you say, as you're walking around, looking at the number of ducks that there are and so on and so forth. But then you've got other options there. Then there's like playing board games with dice. There's playing with manipulatives. There's more formalized maths, you know, like on a big pen and paper, like teaching the kids to do addition and all that kind of thing. Do you have a sense of, is there a kind of hierarchy of these in terms of the effect that they're likely to have? Or what should parents be thinking about if they want to get involved here?
So I think the literature is really kind of interesting on this, because some researchers differentiate the types of activities families do between being formal or informal, or direct and indirect. So those kind of incidental exposures and things that we're doing that are kind of what you would nearly see in a school classroom. And those things have different relations to different mathematical outcomes. So in some researchers have observed that those formal direct exposures, so as you just said about teaching number symbols, maybe doing some really kind of concrete addition, for example, is related to children's more formal mathematics outcomes in school, whereas some of these more informal indirect exposures are related to their, I don't like the term, but number sense, their playfulness with numbers, their understanding of how numbers fit together in a system. There's a few pieces of research that have differentiated in terms of young children who are still in preschool, I suppose, because they're in Belgium, so they're like 6 years old in these studies, so they're still kindergartners, if you know what I mean. It's kids start school a bit later. Have differentiated between advanced and I can't remember what the word they use, advanced and non-advanced activities. And what they see there is a relation between children who are exposed to advanced activities, so slightly more complex mathematics in the early years, and more precocious mathematics skills as they go through development. Now, that for me is really interesting research, but research we have to take really carefully, because the other thing that we know in terms of broader developmental psychology is parental sensitivity is a really good predictor of children's outcomes in general. So what we anticipate in that research that's come out of Belgium is actually parents are not overwhelming their children. They're stretching their children and working within the child's kind of, in a Vygotskian sense, there's the levels of scaffolding, rather than completely overwhelming them and terrifying them with mathematics. So we need to make sure that when we're talking about what parents should do with their children in the home environment, it's much more about parents being able to understand what is, in a broad sense, what's developmentally appropriate, and then being able to really understand your child and know where you can stretch them that little bit. But also recognizing the playfulness of mathematics is so, so important in our early years, that the things that we do that we may think, this isn't mathematics, what am I even doing here, is really, really, really important. So I think some of the things that my daughter really gets a massive kick out of when she was three were things like using shaped telescopes. So, like a kind of a stencil of a triangle and walking around the house and trying to map it onto any triangles or, a rectangle. That's really, really playful, but she's getting to understand shape names. She's getting to understand mental rotation. All of those things that are really, really playful and joyful are really important. So, so there's a brilliant developmental psychology book by Alison Gopnik. She's a fantastic developmental psychologist. And her book is called The Gardener and the Carpenter. And she talks about how parents can sometimes want to, be like a joiner and make their kids, engineer their kids to be super successful. And actually, what we know from a lot of the parenting literature is parents who are good gardeners, who prepare the soil, get the water out, give a little bit of heat, give that exposure, are the parents whose children are happy and rounded and will do well at school as well. So it's getting that balance right of, maybe some of the little bit more formal activities that you can do. A really good example is teaching how to use a clock is a very formal experience, but can be done really playfully. And so getting that balance between being exposure to those kind of more formal mathematics skills, but really focusing on the playfulness of mathematics for our preschoolers is absolutely essential.
Wow, this is interesting. I'm definitely the carpenter in this story here, right? But I tell you what, I'm not even a good carpenter, because this coming back to something you've said there, I think I've gone big on the number side of things, right? So Isaac, he loves number blocks. He's got all the cubes. He knows his square numbers also. And he genuinely seems to enjoy it, right? But, and this is a bias I've got, because I'm not particularly good at shape and space. Like, I really struggle to visualize things in 3D. I'm useless. I'm very poor at that. I always have been. I've not gone big on this shape and space. So he's not doing what your daughter's doing and folding the towel or anything like that. He's clueless on that kind of stuff. But would the research and your findings suggest that the shape and space is just as an important component of this that the number is? Is there a kind of hierarchy there in terms of which one's more important, or is it the obvious thing that the kids need both?
I think that, I hate to give the obvious answer, but it is that they need both. And I think that the thing is that, I suppose this is, again, this kind of goes back to your previous question around parental attitudes. So I think that a lot of parents perceive mathematics as being about number, and that's fine. Okay. That's what we've probably experienced through our own experience of the education system. You know, going back, I'm 40 years old, like that, a number was the big thing. And mathematics is so much, I don't need to tell you this, mathematics is so much more than number.
It seems you do have to tell me though, right? You'd think I'd know this, right? So keep telling me, please.
But, you know, what we see from longitudinal research is that, for example, in the preschool years, patterning is a really important skill to be able to do. That's the basic underpinnings of algebraic functioning, basically, you know, being able to find patterns in materials. And so that's a really important skill. And you're only going to be able to start with patterning really through shape and space. And so being able to bring these things together, shape, space, non-symbolic quantity, you know, playing with quantities, being able to do those stretching activities that would be challenging your working memory and your executive functions, because we know those two things are really important for mathematics development. But also then thinking about number, because obviously our kind of gateway into mathematics through the early years is around understanding the cardinal principle. You know, what does that number really mean? What is the underpinning meaning of that, those number words? So it is kind of like a broad suite of skills that needs to be developed in the preschool years. And I think that's why working in the home math environment space is really exciting, because you can give some really lovely ideas to parents that parents, through our qualitative interviews, actually were fascinating, where parents would say, oh, I don't do anything about mathematics at home with my kid, nothing. And then once they started talking, they're like, oh, yeah, we do. You know, we do this and we do this and we do this. And it's actually kind of beautiful, because these parents are suddenly realizing, oh, my kid is living in a mathematically rich world.
Nice.
But also I think that this is good and reassuring for parents who may have had bad experiences of mathematics in school themselves. Because if they can know that mathematics is not just about numbers, which is probably where, you know, the kind of drill of the multiplication times tables, my seven times tables fear comes back. If they know that that's not the core of what mathematics is about, and there's so many other things that you could do with your children broader than number skills, I think that's also a really reassuring message for parents to hear. And what we're about as a research team as well is not trying to tell parents that they're not doing the right thing. It's about trying to find what parents are doing and saying, these things are really interesting. Have you thought about the opportunity for mathematics within these types of events that you're exposing your children to?
Got it. This is brilliant, this. Board games is something that I often hear as being particularly important. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. And are there certain types of games that are more important to do with students, like ones with dice and counting, or is it just the general idea of games that's the key to this?
So I think in terms of precise board games, I couldn't really give a recommendation, my top five or anything. But what we have seen in broader literature is around some interventions that suggested that board games are helpful for mathematics learning, mainly in the classroom, not necessarily interventions in the home. And what is also interesting is this kind of thinking about these multiple representations of what number is about. So I would say that there's quite a lot of lovely, I don't know if I'm allowed to plug a really nice game, card game that I've used.
Of course, yeah.
It's the tiny number dots card game. It's really great. It's won loads of educational awards. And the cards are kind of, they have number symbols, they have 10 squares on them, they have dots, and there's lots of different ideas for parents to switch up the game. And also the thing that I love about this card game is that when Farah was 3, she could play it, no problem. She's now 6 and she's still being challenged because nice. There's loads of adaptations within the little kind of booklet that comes along with the cards where you can kind of switch it up, which is fantastic. And I think this is one of the things I think is really important when we're thinking about board games or games in general. There is a certain amount of things that we do at home that should really just be about getting kids confident and making them feel brilliant about themselves. And so my daughter will continue to return to a very simple 1 to 10 number race with the dice. And she really, really enjoys that. But I know the reason why she really enjoys it is because she can do it no problem. She can probably do it with her eyes closed, but she feels awesome at the end of it. So parents doing stuff that are kind of straightforward, simple, that's very, very good. And then thinking about those kind of more, you know, ramping up the level of difficulty, we know from the literature suggests that that is something that should be beneficial. But I think it's getting that balance. Again, it is about balance, right? Of building up confidence, but also then being able to have a little bit of challenge in those games as well. The other thing is that we don't necessarily need to challenge with the mathematical content. So it's kind of interesting. At the minute, we're going to be running a EEF-funded trial in England with childcare workers. And that trial is really focusing on, yes, ramping up the number-based challenge, but also then being able to ramp up the executive function challenge to see if these things go together. So you can be doing a game which could be quite straightforward in terms of the number skills that are being used, for example, but you could be trying to make the kid be more challenged with their working memory at the same time. You know, so a simple card game where you're flipping things over and having to remember where these items are, you're stretching that kind of those cognitive skills that we know go alongside mathematics skills as well.
God, this is interesting. I have so many questions for you here. And a lot of these make me sound like a really bad parent, which I'm starting to think maybe I am here with this one. So I wonder, is there any research to suggest any kind of correlation or relationship between the kind of maths environment at home and the kind of literacy or whatever the right phrase is, English environment at home? And the reason I'm saying here is sometimes it feels to me like, obviously, as parents, you've got a finite amount of time to kind of, you know, interact with your child and so on and so forth. And I always have the bias because I love doing the maths that, well, we'll do some maths, right? And then Isaac hangs out with his friends and they can write their name and so on. And Isaac, he's absolutely clueless when it comes to that stuff. But give him a times table, he's banging that out left, right and center. Is there any kind of, you know, trade-off between these two, or is it a kind of positive relationship between the two? Any reflections on that, Vic?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of interesting because it kind of gives the historical context of what we understand about the home environment, because kind of, you know, 15 years ago, people talked about the home learning environment as this kind of one sweeping thing. And then work by Joanne Lefebvre, who's based in Canada, really focused on the home literacy environment. So really specifically looking at that. And actually then Joanne has become kind of one of the pioneers of the home mathematics environment research. So really trying to think about whether these two things are they different, or are they just the two sides of the same coin, basically. And actually what you find is in terms of parents reporting, they are two different things. They differentiate. And you can measure them separately. And if you do some statistical analyses where you can kind of, you can do all this kind of factor analysis and stuff like that, they are two different things. Parents engage with them in a different way. One of the things about the home literacy environment is it is more structured than the home mathematics environment. And that is all driven, well, predominantly driven by this kind of, you know, bedtime story reading, because we recognize that this is something that's good to do as a parent, and we know it's going to happen just before bedtime. So when I asked you, how often did you read to your son last week, you can very easily quantify that. Whereas if I ask you, how many times did you count with your son last week, you're suddenly thinking, I have no idea, actually, because it's not as structured. So these things are different. But when we look at resources, you know, there are some researchers, Joanne Lefebvre being one, who do these kind of great surveys where people have to tick off the board games or the books that they might have at home. And then they have these foils in the surveys as well. They're just completely made up. So you just kind of make sure that people are just not ticking everything.
Yeah, yeah,
what you
yeah.
see is people who have more books at home also have more board games at home,
yeah.
and more resources at home. And that's kind of being driven of, you know, by economics in some ways. But the other thing that I would like to emphasize actually is in our research, sometimes people have said, when I've given a talk, sometimes people have said, well, it's like, you know, the home learning environment, no matter what way you approach it, is that not just the same as like socioeconomic status?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. That is not the same thing. Parents who may be experiencing low income are still trying absolutely to do their best for their children and will expose their children in any way that they can to enable their children's learning, if that's in literacy or if that's in numeracy. So I really have a major issue when I hear people saying that this is like SES, socioeconomic yeah. status, and the home environment are the same thing. They're not the same thing, because we have very rich home mathematics environments in areas of deprivation. We have a lot of deprivation in Northern Ireland, but we also, you know, we worked in Cuba and in Mexico, where we have much lower levels of income, but very rich mathematical experiences going on in the home.
Interesting, really interesting this. Well, that leads me on to this next question. And in a sense, this is another bad question here, because I know we should only really be interested in the things we can influence. But I just wonder if you have a sense of the relative weightings of importance of things like, obviously, the home environment that we're talking about here, the home maths environment, socioeconomic status, and like genetics. How significant is the home environment here in determining kind of students' maths outcomes versus those other two?
Yeah, so I think, look, we know that the huge impact of socioeconomic status on children's attainment, and, you know, interestingly, you know, there's a large study going on in the States of just giving families money to see if this improves
yeah.
children's
yeah.
attainment outcomes. And there is chat of you know, attempting to do the same in the UK. So, you know, we know that this is a major driver. As I've said before, you know, we are seeing this kind of 0.2 relation to between the home math environment and children's learning. And that is going over, you know, over and above SES and some of these kind of large meta-analyses. So, you know, I do think that we can see that it's not the same thing, but it's definitely a contributor to children's early learning. I think the really kind of massive caveat here is that all of those studies have mainly focused on frequencies. And what we're really interested in now is really about the quality and can we change the quality? So very exciting is that we've got funding from the Nuffield Foundation for a project that's just starting. I interviewed for the postdoc for the project today. And what we'll be doing is we've got lots of data that we want to reanalyze to kind of get to know some bigger questions again, especially around socioeconomic status and the frequency of activities, of home mathematics activities. But then what we're going to do is we're going to work with parents who are experiencing low income to co-produce resources for home and to work with their 3 to 5 year olds. So we're really excited about getting on the ground with parents who we've been working with a number of charities in Northern Ireland for a while, and we can't wait to start that. We've got collaborators in Sheffield as well. And then we're going to run a pilot and feasibility study to see whether this changes children's outcomes through the use of these resources in the home. And really what we're talking about here is not necessarily, maybe parents will suggest to us this is, they want to do lots of, the frequency is really important for them, that's like to be decided. But what I anticipate this is going to be around is going to be around giving and ensuring access to quality resources and also providing parents with some support to boost their confidence around early mathematics themselves. So this will be trying to tap into that quality question in a really empirical way. And I suppose the way for us to develop a good intervention is through a randomized controlled trial process, but also for us to understand that causal pathway. Is the home mathematics environment causally influencing children's outcomes? The only way for us really to understand that and really get to that is through a randomized controlled trial. So that's what we're kind of trying to put out the building blocks for. And that project is starting imminently.
Wow. Wow. Oh, that's dead exciting, that. This is brilliant. This, right. I have another bad question coming up here. So you mentioned something at the start.
A series of bad questions.
Yeah, it's the way where we do this. So you mentioned something right at the start, and it's kind of alerted one of my big fears I'm having here. So as I said, this is more of a therapy session for me, Vic, here. So what I'm worried about when Isaac goes to school in September is that I know as a kind of teacher or former teacher myself, rightly or wrong, well, in fact, not rightly or wrongly, definitely wrongly, first impressions really matter, right? So when I teach students, those initial first lessons really kind of put in mind what that kid's going to be like. And particularly if I've got kind of data to back it up. So if I'm told last year they got a really high score in their maths or their targets, that I'm thinking, all right, it's terrible this, but I'm labeling them as a kind of high achiever, blah, 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 and so on and so forth. So when you said at the start that when kids start school, if their kind of maths kind of achievement level is quite low, it remains low kind of throughout. Do you get a sense of what's the causal factor there? Is that something to do with teacher perception at all? Or is that just once you're locked in at that level, it's very hard no matter what you do to kind of boost up? Do you get a sense of what's going on there? Because it's quite a concern, right? That something, you know, at that point in time can have such a kind of almost long-lasting impact.
Yeah, and I think that this is the big question, I think, in educational research from my perspective is why are these skills so immutable? You know, why are children who are entering into school with low performance basically subtracting their peers? And you know, the longitudinal research that has happened in the States has been replicated in other places and shows very similar kind of evidence. Now, these children are not necessarily receiving intervention because these are just longitudinal cohort studies. So obviously there's individual variation across there. And I suppose for me, what is driving this? Well, you know, you kind of said a few things that, you know, sometimes we think genetics is this kind of blueprint that is, you know, deterministic and cannot be shifted. Whereas actually there's some really great work by Kevin Mitchell, for example. He's written this book called Innate that talks about these kind of multiple rolling valleys of pathways that your genetic blueprint can kind of shift and strive because it's interacting with the environment all the time. Your genetics are interacting with the environment. So, you know, my question is there something around the home environment that is interacting with their kind of genetic heritage, this, you know, this kind of your own interest? This is another thing that we don't necessarily always think about, but little kids are inquisitive by nature. And we know from those of, like, even from the work of Piaget, talked about how they determine their own environment as well. They're seeking out experiences that give them the hit, give, you know, their motivational hit. So, you know, it's the interaction of all of these different experiences and the cognitive skills that they're bringing along to the table in the first place that I'm kind of intrigued by. I've actually forgot your question. Am I answering your question?
I was coming at it from the angle of kind of teacher perception. I wondered whether that was a thing.
Yes.
And again, make me not look the world's worst, both parent and teacher in this. I'm aware that there is research that if teachers are told something about a student, it really informs their perception of them above and beyond what they would kind of, the kind of visual evidence they would collect themselves. So I just wondered whether there's any of that going on at all.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. And you know, as you say, there is evidence that this kind of labeling processes are not helpful. But I also think that there is something about mathematics where we get kids on a treadmill of learning where we are very, very focused on progression. And, you know, that's not teachers' fault. That is this is the system that we have built, an educational system that we have built that's very, you know, focused on assessment, etc. When actually in terms of mathematics, if you don't have the foundational building blocks, you're going to struggle. And we know that absolutely. And so, for example, I know you've spoken to Camilla Gilmore before, but you know, Camilla Gilmore and myself and a number of other collaborators have looked at the effect of being born very early on later mathematics skills. And one of the very obvious things about that group of children, not all kids born very preterm will struggle with maths, but the kids who are struggling is that their foundational building blocks are quite weak. You know, being able to count forwards and backwards, for example. they're struggling with those types of skills. And so that requires a teacher to be very confident in themselves to be able to say, right, let's drop down a level here. We need to go back to the building blocks. So sometimes the what we may be seeing in terms of those like longitudinal mapping is because the kids are having to go on the treadmill that's pushing them beyond the foundational skills that they have. When I think about also some of the assessments that I did with some of these children born very preterm, they were 8 to 10 years old and they were still using their fingers to do very simple arithmetic. And actually, more troublingly, they would use their fingers but hide them under the table or put them underneath their thighs because they were told that they weren't allowed to use manipulatives anymore because they were big girls and boys. And so that requires teachers to be able to recognize and say, actually, at this point in time, get the counters out, get the number line out, let's use the manipulatives because we really want you to feel confident with those foundational skills. And so those things may be playing into that even more so than labeling of children. It may be about this kind of, can we feel confident enough as teachers to drop down a level to make sure that these foundational skills are really secure before we keep on pushing on to the next level? And I know that I am sure that when my daughter's teachers see me coming to parents' evenings, they must think, oh no.
Yeah.
Because in primary one, so my we start a little bit earlier in Northern Ireland for school started. My daughter's primary one teacher said, she's really good with manipulatives. She's fantastic. She's five. She was five, right? Yeah, four. Yeah, four and a bit. Really good with manipulatives. But when I take the manipulatives away, it's awful. I'm like, give this little kid the manipulatives. Yeah, like, this is like totally appropriate for her to be able to use them. So then when you put it in the face of kids who are struggling, who've entered school at a slightly lower level than their peers, and things are starting to be removed from them in the classroom that would be really supportive, I think sometimes we just need to have that differentiation in the classroom to enable kids to be able to use any strategy that's around them to be able to help them bolster their confidence and to be able to practice the things that we want them to practice in a really intuitive, accessible way.
That's brilliant. That I've got two more questions based on what we've talked about. Then I'll throw it over to you just in case there's anything that we haven't kind of covered about your research. So the first is you mentioned kind of quality resources that are made available to parents as part of these studies. If you can just give us a few examples, what would you consider to be quality resources that could improve kind of math home learning environment?
So I suppose for me, when I say quality resources, they don't have to be sophisticated. So it's thinking about what things parents have in the home that you can use in a mathematical way. So, you know, that might be about really trying to draw out. So this is about the resources in the parent's head, nearly, I suppose, is a better way to think about it. So I have a really nice video that we developed. My daughter and I are co-producers of educational content. We developed these little videos during lockdown, actually, of us doing some baking together. And what I intentionally did was draw on the literature of David Perpura from the United States, who's done a lot of work on mathematical language. So it was when we were doing this baking experience, I really tried to intentionally draw out any mathematical language I could use. More, less, heavier, lighter, bigger, smaller, add two eggs into the bowl. So we had this like 15 minute interaction. And when I look back at the video, it's laden with mathematical language. In context, I suppose that's a really important thing, isn't it? Showing her how usable mathematical language is. So, you know, we're talking about high quality resources. Some of this can be high quality resources in your brain, but then also being able to identify good resources that are available that are cheap as well. So, for example, Jo van Herbergen and Laura Outhwaite at University College London have done a really nice Nuffield Foundation funded study that they've looked at mathematical apps. So really looking at them through a very empirical lens to really assess the quality of those applications to give parents advice about what type of app would be a good app to use. So you can kind of take it from the two extremes there, can't you, really? You know, these applications that are technology-based that parents might be terrified of, but then you've also got this kind of resource that is a parent's brain and trying to get them just to think a little bit more intentionally, perhaps, or just being a little bit more aware that maths is all around you and kind of you can kind of bring those to the middle. But like the best thing I think that I have in my house And I know that actually Camilla Gilmore and Emily Farron have done an intervention around this and found really nice positive benefits, is our building blocks and Lego blocks.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's so much opportunity to have mathematical language around, especially the Lego blocks, because they have the little dots, etc. And you can do all of this lovely comparing and contrasting along with all the building and the mental rotation. You know, those things are simple resources that can be really, really effective when you're playing with your children and thinking about the mathematical environment in which they're growing up in.
It's really interesting. And my final question, and again, I know you said that there's kind of limited research on this, but I wonder if you just touch upon it a little bit. Older primary school students and kind of secondary school students, could you just summarize what we know about what an effective home maths environment might look like for those students?
I think, well, there are a number of researchers that have looked at this. And I think the one thing that we know, as I said earlier on, is, you know, an effective home math environment is a sensitive home math environment. So when children are really struggling, it's about parental sensitivity towards those issues. So for example, I've seen some really nice research recently around parents who are reporting high levels of mathematics anxiety themselves, and then looking at their interaction with their child. So while they're doing homework helping, and that can be a very difficult relationship to navigate when you really, really want to help your child, but they're doing something that maybe actually terrifies you. So understanding the limits to which you want to extend yourself, I suppose, as a parent there, and also realizing that the sensitivity of being able to communicate effectively when things are maybe just a bit too stressful, and not wanting to increase the level of anxiety in that in your child, or to decrease their confidence. But I think the thing that is important in terms of the home math environment as children get older is pretty much the same as what we see when we're looking at these preschoolers. That is about being able to be supportive, about being able to recognize that mathematics is all around you, even when it's getting more complex, and being able to be playful about mathematics. So we still see the effects of playing mathematical board games, doing those types of more complex measurement, for example, that older children can get really involved in, that is also really important. So we still see this consistent relationship, even though it is small, but that extends throughout primary school. And the evidence, there is some evidence in adolescence, but it is it's not as researched as much as the primary school age group.
That's super useful. That's brilliant. I'm about to ask you kind of a general reflection question, but before I do, is there anything about your research that we haven't covered, Vic, that you wanted to make people aware of?
I suppose the one thing that is important to say is that in terms of the research across the world, and, you know, we're saying about this kind of, you know, weak relationship between the home mathematics environment and children's outcomes. One of the things that's really interesting, in fact, is that in the UK, we find sometimes no relationship whatsoever. And so this is really fascinating.
This is a twist actually, at the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I know. actually, one of our studies has found no relationship whatsoever in terms of children's pathways of learning. So we track children over time from 3 to 5 years old. And what we found, actually, the things that predicted their outcomes in that study was actually their vocabulary. So children's, and we think that is about how kids access the learning materials once they enter into school, and also their working memory, which we always know is related to mathematics. And there are two reasons for this. I think one reason is sometimes around how we measure the home mathematics environment. We're talking about frequencies in that study rather than the quality of the interaction. But I think also is the kind of washout effect that we might get because of the quality of our childcare provision in the UK. Now, I know many people under earlier settings, childcare and earlier settings, I know many people will have differing views around how people are trained to work in those childcare settings or in earlier settings. But I actually think when you look at it comparatively across the world, we have a highly educated workforce on the main. When we compare that to the USA, childcare workers and early years workers are not necessarily as well trained. So what we might be seeing, in fact, is, yeah, the home math environment may be effective, but actually, because we've got quite high quality early years sector, then that kind of effect is being washed out in some of the UK studies. this is very much me hypothesizing and very much conversations that I've had with other collaborators trying to understand some of our null effects. But that's why we're really trying to focus on the quality of the home math environment in terms of our future research, because, you know, through the intervention studies that we're seeing this effect of the home math environment on outcomes, which are much more quality focused. Then we feel intuitively that there should be an impact. But in the UK, we're finding these quite disparate results.
It's really interesting. That's fascinating, that. My final question, Vic, just a general reflection, is what's an example of something important you've changed your mind about?
I think, honestly, for me, I feel like my research career has taken this kind of, you said a curveball there, my last answer has taken a massive curveball, because I was trained in this kind of very empiricist cognitive background. My PhD was on automaticity of facts, you know, like, could you get any more coggy than that? And, you know, I think the thing that I missed out on, and it was actually at my PhD viva, my external examiner from Leuven in Belgium said, "But Victoria, you can't think about these children as little brains, and individual little brains in the classroom." And I think for me, stepping into children's social environments, because, you know, the home mathematics environment, we have to remember, is a social environment. Stepping into those social environments is really messy, because as I've explained the whole way through this conversation, it's really hard to measure. But for me, that change in approach has been really fulfilling. And I think a biggest learning lesson that I've had was I attempted to apply my cognitive lens to something that is inherently social, and that doesn't necessarily work. So trying to understand development in a more holistic way has been a really big learning experience for me.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, that. Well, it's over to you, Vic, for your big three. So what would be three resources, websites, whatever you want that you'd recommend our listeners check out? And I'll put links to these in the show notes.
Brilliant. So I think the first one I would really recommend is the Dream Network. They're an American-based research group who are really focused on family math resources. So it is American, but it has really good resources from preschool right through school-aged children, really good free resources to access. More closer to home, Maths on Toast is a brilliant website. They describe themselves as the maths family charity. They have great activities, and I suppose their aspiration is to think about mathematics the way we talked about bedtime book time reading, to kind of normalize those events in families' lives. Finally, I have mentioned it already, and if you're interested in parenting and any shape or form, I would really, really recommend reading Alison Gopnik's book, The Gardener and the Carpenter. It was published in 2016, so actually now thinking about it, it's getting a bit old. But she is an unbelievable communicator, totally on top of the scientific evidence base, but also has a really strong message about parenting and kind of like the kickback to this kind of engineering of children and the support of being good gardener parents.
Wow. Okay, that's two things I'm buying straight away after this. So I'm on to Gardener and the Carpenter, because I've got to sort myself out there. And that Tiny Number Dots card game sounds absolutely brilliant,
it's so
as well.
Good.
So Amazon's going to get a few quid from me as a result of that. That's brilliant. Well, I tell you what, Vic, I've loved every minute of this. It's been an area that I've obviously got a very current personal interest in, but I've always been fascinated in this through my time as a teacher, like the role that parents are playing. And this has been fascinating. And it sounds like you've got some really interesting studies coming up on this as well. So hopefully we can catch up in the future about some of the things you find out. But for now,
totally.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.